Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
In 1984, Bruno Mansour gave up his clothes, his money, and his possessions to live with the Penan people in the forest interior of Malaysian Borneo. By 1990, Malaysia had declared Mansour as the number one enemy of the state. It's time to eat the dogs. I'm Michael Robinson. Today, Carl Hoffman talks about Bruno Mansour and Michael Palmieri, two Western men who arrived in Borneo with very different dreams and aspirations. Hoffman is a former contributing editor to National Geographic Traveler and Wired magazine. He is also the author of The Lunatic Express and Savage Harvest. I spoke with him today about his latest book, The Last Wild Men of Borneo, a true story of death and treasure. Carl Hoffman, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
One of the men who you talk about in your book is Bruno Mansour, who grows up in Switzerland in the 1960s. And what struck me about him is, even at this time of individualism and social revolutions, he really seems to be following his own path. What made Mansour so different?
Well, I think that's a good question. I mean, you know, what makes any of us do anything? And I don't think there's an easy answer for Bruno. You know, he was a large family. It was a largely blue-collar family in a place, Switzerland, where sort of a stark individualism, the kind of individualism that we think of as an American trait, is so prevalent. And yet Bruno, from the earliest memories, the earliest stories of him, was always this kind of oddball who was following his own path. And that was in particular just he wanted to be outside. He wanted to be in nature. He wanted to be out on his balcony suffering in the cold. He wanted to be exploring in the woods. And that's always just the way he was.
Yeah, he ended up taking some pretty epic trips up these mountains in the summertime in the Swiss Alps to tend sheep, and without anything for months at a time.
Yeah, well, I like to think of it as kind of an apprenticeship that both of the characters in The Last Wild Men of Borneo undertake. And they both undertook this sort of 10-year apprenticeship. And in Bruno's case, He had been drafted by the Swiss military. All men must serve. And he had basically become a conscientious objector and was tried and sentenced and actually went to prison for 4 months or so. And when he came out of prison, he just lit up for the French Alps, I mean, for the Swiss Alps. And he spent a few years herding cows and milk making cow's milk cheese, cow milk cheese. And then he turned to sheep and shepherding he could do alone, making the cheese. He needed a couple partners. And so he spent about 10 years altogether, 6 years herding sheep, very remote parts of the Alps. I mean, the Alps, I've been to the little house, little shepherd's hut that he lived in. And I mean, it's a spectacularly beautiful place, just this little wooden hut in kind of a, at the top of a box canyon, surrounded by, right up really at the tree line, a little bit above it, with views and rushing streams. And he just spent every summer up there by himself.
By the early 1980s, he's traveling further and further from Europe. He arrives in Borneo and attaches himself to a British caving expedition. And then he sets off on his own to live with the Penan people deep in the forests of Borneo, particularly Sarawak, the Malaysian part of Borneo. What was Mansur trying to do?
Well, that too is a good question in certain ways. As much as Bruno talked about what he did, and he didn't go that deeply into explaining what he was after, except to say that he wanted to be in the belly of the mother. Sort of, it's metaphorical, this idea of being in nature in particular and with people who revered nature. And he wanted to be in a place that was with without money. He wanted no commodification of anything. He wanted to be in a cashless economy with people who shared everything. The Penan, you know, we should talk a little bit about the Penan people, because in order to understand what Bruno did, you really have to understand the Penan, who were unusual in Borneo itself, a place of hundreds of different tribes, usually called Dayaks collectively, even though lots of different variations in language and culture. And the Penan were the nomads of the forest. They lived in the highest, remotest parts of Borneo, mostly in Sarawak now. And most of the Dayaks were lived in great longhouses, these, you know, 300-foot longhouses, and were had traditionally been headhunters and had this very high culture and were artists and shamans and lived a fairly sedentary life, except although they moved maybe every generation or so as their slash and burn rice fields were worn out. And the Penan were kind of the opposite of the most of the Dayaks. They were pure nomadic hunter-gatherers. They built these very small sort of temporary huts, and they moved them every, could be every couple weeks, could be every couple months. And that's what Bruno wanted. He wanted, he said over and over again, he just wanted to be living in this sort of idealized, to Bruno, Edenesque world where everybody shared everything and there was no money, no commerce, no pressure of productivity.
Yeah. And what was amazing to me is that he decides he's going to just troop off into the jungle and live with these people. And then he actually does that. I mean, he manages to find his way into the densest part of the Sarawak jungle, finds a group of Penan people who basically accept him. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that fascinated me about Bruno and his story is that I had spent increasing amounts of time, well, in particular in my first, in my previous book about the disappearance of Michael Rockefeller, living with the Asmat people in the southwest coast of New Guinea. And and that had been a powerful experience to me. And I'd grown up reading tales of exploration, and there's this sort of long Western idealization and fantasy about becoming the other, about going into a remote land and kind of becoming one of the tribe. And yet also in that, you know, most people kind of go in, the reality is that most people go in and they stay for a month or a year and then they come out. And yeah, what was different right. about Bruno is the kind of level of commitment. I mean, he had this fantasy, a fantasy that so many of us have, and that I certainly had. And he went in and he did this incredible kind of epic trek, to 10-day trek to find the Pinon. I mean, this was before GPS, and he had no real maps, and he ran out of food, and he almost starved, and he finally found them. And then he just stayed. You know, at first they didn't pay him much attention at all, and they were like, you know, who's this guy? And but over time, you know, he stayed so long and became so Pinon that the Pinon themselves called him Lucky Pinon, Pinon Man.
Yeah.
And, you know, he learned their language, and he learned to walk through the jungle barefoot and to hunt with a blowpipe and to climb trees. And he could find his way through the forest, and he became, you know, essentially self-sufficient. He wasn't a drag on the Pinon. And he stayed for 6 years. And, you know, we can talk about why he left, but that's a long time.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, the longer he stayed, I mean, you know, this is 1984 when he went in. So Pinon liked to wear watches, even though the watches were usually broken as jewelry. And they, you know, were wearing T-shirts and gym shorts like people all over the world. And, you know, Bruno kind of went the other direction. I mean, he was exploring, you know, traditional Pinon loincloths out of bark and wearing them and growing his hair in a Pinon style, which is kind of like a mullet, even as the Pinon were going in the other direction.
Yeah, you have some great photographs of him in your book. I was wondering, you had said that Monser had become a kind of, started to live out a kind of Western fantasy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that, you know, for years, centuries, I mean, the Westerners have had a long Western, especially kind of literary fantasy about Westerners who go and become a exotic tribesmen. I mean, you know, that's what, in a way, the whole Tarzan fantasy, mm-hmm. which is, you know, series is about. I mean, I reread it recently, and it's a horribly racist book, but it really captures what Westerners have felt for generations, really. And Bruno had these ideas that, you know, I think the book explores them. And here's the thing. Bruno saw the Pinon as these sort of ahistorical characters who were living this life that was untouched by the modern mm-hmm. world. And the reality was that wasn't true. You know, the Pinon had been in these strange kind of vassal relationships with the sedentary, violent, headhunting Dayaks for generations. The Dayaks used the Pinon to gather certain jungle products, which were important to them, which they traded to Chinese traders for a profit. And they dominated the Pinon, and it was the Brooks, you know, Charles Brooke and James Brooke, who, you know, ruled Sarawak.
This is the British Raja.
Yeah, the White Rajas of Sarawak. I mean, you know, talk about weird fantasy, Western fantasies. And they institute, you know, the Brooke regime instituted this these quarterly markets where the Pinon could trade their products to the Dayaks under the watchful eye of Brooke government officials so that they wouldn't be cheated. And the Pinon, you know, looked upon the British as these kind of saviors. And even though there were Pinon who may not have seen themselves a Westerner, that may be a little bit doubtful, but I'm sure there were some, and who appeared to live incredibly traditional lives, they were all part of a system, I mean, in which they, you know, were aware of the outside world and had these relationships with Dayaks and this relationship with the British, with the Brooks. And you know, they looked at Bruno as this sort of one of the Brooks returned in yeah. a way. They didn't venerate him. They didn't carry him around on a chair the way the Malaysian government, you know, made it sound. But they looked at Bruno as this person as what he was, which was a person of a Western power. And yet Bruno looked at them as this pure, free people, which in a way they were, who had been untouched by time and history. So, you know, they were both, to me, that's what's really fascinating about the story, is the way they were both kind of fetishizing the other in a certain way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it's really interesting the degree to which he becomes different things to different people, a kind of a bandit to the Malaysian authorities and a hero to the Pinon, as well as, as you said, a kind of fantasy figure for people back in Europe. There is even a little bit of the Commander Kurtz quality, you know, to him, this Westerner going in and leading a group of people in a fight.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Western fantasy. I mean, it's T. E. Lawrence of the jungle in a way, you know. And when Bruno first started really becoming well known and leading the Pinon in anti-logging efforts, there was this flood of reporters who started going in originally from Europe, from Stern and from Geo and, you know, the big kind of magazines. And Bruno himself became frustrated because all the reporters, you know, they found something incredible to them. And that incredible thing wasn't, you know, it was kind of the Pinon resisting all of these rapacious loggers and politicians. But really, the fascinating thing was Bruno. The fascinating thing was the white guy, you know, with this naked, with his blowpipe, who could climb trees and hunt, you know, with poison arrows. I mean, that's what they were fascinated by. It was Tarzan incarnate. It was Tarzan come to life. And, you know, here was this sort of savage that, you know, you could sit down with to dinner with and speak a flawless, you know, Swiss German and French and English and Malaysian. I mean, you know, Bruno was the fantasy come to life.
Yeah. And then simultaneously, you have this other figure that your book also traces the story of, Michael Palmieri, who is an American trader and an adventurer, kind of a buccaneer who... He also ends up in Borneo in the 1970s and 80s, but he's a really different sort of person than Bruno Montserre. Could you talk about him?
Yeah, I mean, Bruno and Michael are completely opposite on the surface. They're, you know, when Bruno went in to live with the Pinon, he wanted nothing. He didn't go. He became famous, but he wasn't searching for fame, and he certainly wasn't searching for profit. I mean, completely the opposite. And then the movement that he led in Sarawak was completely sort of selfless, in the sense that he was doing it for the Pinon alone and to help them preserve their land and their way of life. I mean, land and life being inextricably linked there. And Michael was an American who was going in and out of Borneo for 40 years, buying the sacred art, beautiful carvings and paintings and textiles of the Dayak people, and selling them for a profit to museums and collectors around the world. But when I looked more closely at them, they were really two peas from the same pod in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, they were both baby boomers from the 60s. They'd both been called to serve by their militaries. Michael, like Bruno, had refused to serve. He had been sort of proto-drafted, not actually drafted yet, but he'd been called for a physical, and he just split. He threw the letter in the trash and hit the road, went to Mexico and then to Europe. And he, like Bruno, spent 10 years kind of wandering and in Michael's case, all over Europe and then into further and further east through Iran and into India and Afghanistan, and making these epic overland journeys between Europe and Afghanistan, trading and smuggling. It was only after doing that for 10 years that he made his way to Bali and then into Borneo. So when I looked at them, I felt like both Michael and Bruno were really representatives of the same thing. I mean, they were both people who were looking for something, looking for a treasure, like desperately in search of a treasure, and the treasure of remote indigenous people, and that the art Michael was bringing out was really just the physical manifestation of the thing that Bruno was seeking, trying to be in the belly of the mother. I mean, that's what sacred tribal art is.
Yeah. One of the things that kind of fascinated me about your book was that, you know, in the work I do, I'm very acquainted with these types of characters that you're talking about, the people who are searching for something. What's so interesting to me is that in the case of Palmieri, well, actually in Mansur as well, that their links to really powerful things back home is kind of surprising. In Palmieri's case, he's doing collecting for some of these really, really high-priced dealers in Europe and North America. His work ends up being profiled in museums around the world. Could you talk about the links between Palmieri and the museum trade, for example?
Well, the museum trade is complicated, and it's this whole kind of gray world. I mean, the art world in general is. In Michael's case, you know, he wasn't. You can go into the Yale Museum of Art, for instance, today, and see pieces that he collected, and museums all over, and those museums did not send him out. You know, they didn't call him up and say, we're looking for something. You know, Michael was out there and he was collecting, and, you know, it kind of reached its apex in the early 80s. I mean, late 70s, early 80s, when Michael had ended up purchasing this 100-foot Mahakam River boat. And, you know, it was like he was ranging through Borneo with a tractor trailer, bringing this stuff out that he sold to mostly to sort of middlemen, and those middlemen then later donated or sold to these museums. But the whole industry of, you know, the museum industry period, whether it's tribal art or African art or Asian art, you know, is the history of people who are like Michael, who are out there and in this sort of shady gray world, wheeling and dealing. And somehow by the time the stuff gets to, you know, the Yale Museum, it has this sort of patina of legitimacy. When you go into a place like the Yale Museum and you look at these powerful, very old sculptures, you know, what are they, you know, why do you love them, and why are they fascinating, and what feelings do they evoke? And, you know, I think it's all part of this idea that we kind of hunger for the sacred worlds that they represent.
You ask Michael Palmieri, you travel with him in Borneo, and at one point you ask him, if he could be any age, what would he be? And he says, I'd be 30. And then he goes on to tell you how that was such a pivotal moment for him, where he escaped his draft call and couldn't really return home. And it was at that moment that his life changed forever. And you write in your book, those words hit me hard. There was something that happened in a certain way to all of us, how the choices we made put us on rivers that carried us to our fates, journeys that became harder and harder to disembark from the older we got. Why does this hit you hard?
Well, I think it's in a way it's you know, the it's sort of acknowledging what the universal what universally happens to us as we age. I mean, I'm in my 50s and I'm, you know, acutely aware of that, that you have hopes and dreams and, you know, and the world is yours. You know, you can do anything when you're in your 20s and, you know, slowly you make various choices, whether it's getting married and having a family or, you know, suddenly you get a mortgage and, you know, your time, on the one hand, you have more obligations. On the other hand, time feels like it's running out, or your physical body begins to decline and you can't do what you used to be able to do. And suddenly, you know, it turns out you've made a lot of choices along the road of your life, and you're kind of stuck with those in a lot of ways. And I think that is kind of a theme of the whole book in a way. And it happens, I guess, you know, you think of, in particular about, the thing is, you think about, like, in a very sort of bourgeois middle class way, you know, people who get up and they get in their, you know, their car and they drive to work every day and they do some job that's kind of boring and they dream about doing something else. And, you know, they're mortgaged to the hilt and they're stuck in that life. And, you know, then you think of someone like Michael Palmieri, who's, you know, been, who hasn't lived in America for 40 years and lives in, as he calls it, his little grass shack in Bali, and, you know, has had this wildly adventurous life. Or someone like Bruno, who, you know, lit out and lived in the jungle for 6 years as a wild indigenous person, and then led this incredible movement for 10 years as people who broke from that mold. But I think what I understood when Michael said those words to me, and what I'd been seeing when I was examining the lives of both Michael and Bruno, was that they too got stuck. They got just as stuck as everybody else. You know, and there's a, I think the big, almost the biggest moment of the book is when Bruno's friend, a man named George Rueg, who had been a shepherd with Bruno, he'd been on the other side of the mountain from Bruno in his shepherding years, said to me, you know, I was a shepherd for so many years, and it was the most beautiful life I could ever imagine. He goes, but my knees got bad. And he's like, I couldn't do it anymore. And he said, you know, when that happens, and he had to kind of come off the mountain and live a much more regular life and become a carpenter. And he said, you know, when that happens, you have to accept it, and you have to have sort of new goals and new dreams and new horizons. And that if you don't, you not just get stuck, you kind of die. And he said Bruno never could do that, you know, and Michael to a certain extent never, well, he, the thing is, he never changed his life, but he always, that's the amazing thing about Michael, he has this kind of adventurousness and optimism that has kept him out there for, you know, he's 75 years old now. And he hasn't given up.
Yeah, when I read that, it was really interesting. It kind of crystallized something for me. And at the period that this is taking place, in the 80s, I was living in Egypt in the late 80s, and I had a job. I was teaching English at a school in Cairo, but on the weekends, we would go to the Sinai and go snorkeling and that sort of thing. And we would run into lots of Western travelers, expats, a lot of Kiwis and Aussies, and they would roll through. And they fit a lot of the types that you talk about that exist in Bali in the 1980s as well. And I remember thinking to myself, like, that was one path. We were all in Egypt working in a way because we were also chasing that thing that you were talking about. But I realized that for some people, it had become almost a kind of profession, a kind of traveling career. And that it seemed interesting to me that it was almost it almost seemed like a choice by default. And I never really put it together until I read your words on that. But you have written about other Westerners as well. As you mentioned earlier, you wrote a book, Savage Harvest, about Michael Rockefeller, who went missing in New Guinea in the early 60s. And you've written about your own travels in a book called The Lunatic Express. I was wondering if you could talk about what draws you to this kind of story.
Well, it's funny. It's a good question. It's one I'm kind of thinking about and grappling with now as I think about other projects past Last Wild Men of Borneo. And I mean, I think there are a bunch of things going on. One, you know, when I was a kid, I loved sort of some of the first, well, the first books that I truly loved were Arthur Ransom's Swallows and Amazon series. And Ransom was a British writer. He'd been a reporter, and he'd covered the Russian Revolution, and he married Trotsky's secretary. And then he wrote these 12 fantastic, they're young adult books, but really adults can read them. And, you know, they're about kids seeking adventure. And from there, there's the sort of opening in the very first book, the kids, these are the four Walker children, go to a summer vacation with their mom, and their dad's out off. He's a sea captain, so he's away. And they, the first day, they're wandering and exploring, and they find a boathouse on the lake. And in the boathouse is a little boat, sailboat. And they, I'm paraphrasing a little bit. Ransom is more eloquent than I am, but they say, well, you know, with a boat in a boathouse, and they see a little island in the middle of the lake with a lake and a boat on and a small boat in a boathouse and an island in the middle of the lake. Nothing but a voyage of discovery seemed worth thinking about, which I think is sort of a beautiful description of the birth of wanderlust. And, you know, for me, then I sort of went into fantasy books. I read all these fantasy books, which in later life, recently, I've come to realize that, you know, places like Borneo and Azmat in New Guinea and some of the places that I went in Lunatic are really the reality of those sort of other worlds that I fantasized mm-hmm. about in those fantasy books, really, and kind of heroic journeys, you know, like Campbell's, you know, The Hero's Journey. I mean,
sure.
I'm kind of stuck on that a little bit. I mean, that's my thing in my own. I'm reliving that kind of over and over again, this sort of archetype of the hero's journey into a wild and strange land, and it's the interface of us and those wild, strange lands that fascinates me, and it continues to fascinate me.
Carl Hoffman, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
That's it for today. The music was composed by Zabrat. Make sure you check out the Time to Eat the Dogs website for podcast links and other exploration-related stuff. And if you get the chance, please take a minute to rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps make the show visible to new listeners. And if you want to recommend a guest or make a comment, feel free to contact me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. See you next week.